This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WVAI. In today's program, we consider the fact that January is a most significant month for the nation of South Africa. This month marks South Africa's taking over the presidency of the Security Council at the United Nations. It is also the 100th anniversary of the founding of the African National Congress. And in today's program, here in our studios, we will be speaking live with the Consul General, George Manyamangene. So stay tuned for that and more on today's edition of 5 O'Clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow, and our focus in today's program is the history, current events, and future of South Africa. And this marks the 100th anniversary, the centennial of the founding of the African National Congress by John Dube. 100 years ago, the Native Congress of South Africa, which later became the African National Congress, began a long battle to overcome Christian missionaries and white supremacy, leading to the ultimate democratic victory of the majority population in that nation. Throughout the year, South Africa is celebrating that history and looking towards its future as a way that one might lead oneself out of the legacy problems of the apartheid state and white supremacy. We begin the program with a reflection on how South Africa got to where it is today, and the African National Congress did, with this just from a day ago at a special event commemorating the centennial, an address by Amani Jale on the legacy of John Dube and the African National Congress.
I speak to you as the representative of the family of John Langalibalele Dube and as chairman of the J.L. Dube Foundation. To address you today is for me an honor and a welcome task. J.L. Dube was and remains a man of multiple roles and a single-minded diplomatic taskmaster. He was an ordained man of the cloth, an entrepreneur, an author, a journalist, a songwriter, an educationist, a visionary, and above all, a selfless community and political leader. In many ways, he was far ahead of his times. So much of what he founded or helped to found many years ago remains in existence till today. To mention but a few of his landmark achievements, in 1887, when he was 16 years old, and after a stint at Adams College in Natal, he went to further his education at the Oberlin College in Ohio, United States of America. This was an initiative of his foremost American mentor, the Reverend William Cullen Wilcox. His vision and attitude towards life was influenced by his role models. His father, James Ngatsiana Dube, the Reverend Wilcox, and the founder of the Tuskegee Normal and Industrial Institute, Booker T. Washington, among others. He founded Ohlange Institute as an independent Christian industrial school for African students of Southern Africa to teach the hand to work, the brain to think, and the heart to serve. The school, which was then modeled on the Tuskegee Institute, still exists. Its doors opened on July 26, 1901. However, the school is now a physical and administrative abomination. The discipline and the level and quality of teaching at the school is nothing but a disaster. Having said that, I'm happy to state that a plan to restore the school to its former glory is in the offing. J.L. Dube also founded a newspaper, Ilanga laseNatal, the first edition of which appeared in April 1903. The newspaper was first produced at the Ohlange Institute with the assistance of student labor. To this day, the newspaper, now called Ilanga, is still on the newsstands. Without much ado, and in absentia, on 8 January 1912, he was elected the first president of the South African Native National Congress in Mangaung. It is common knowledge that the South African Native National Congress became what is today known as the African National Congress. In 1914, he led a Congress delegation to express the grievances of black South Africans against the Native Land Act of 1913 and other discriminatory laws imposed upon black people. The delegation comprised such high-profile leaders as Thomas Mapigela, Walter Kubusana, Saul Msane, Solomon Plaichi, and Pixley Ka-Isaka Seme. History bears evidence to the fact that matters of land tenure and ownership were close to Dube's heart. Mr. President, ladies and gentlemen, in brief, that is the legacy of John Langalibalele Dube. All of this was not without challenge, conflict, contradiction, doubt, and even suspicion and denouncement. 4. John Dube and his peers and contemporaries were mortal and fallible human beings, flesh and blood. In order to fully understand and appreciate them as leaders, one needs to understand the context and circumstances of their time and space. They lived at a time of great change in their own country and the world. A time when our people were torn apart between their upbringing in traditional African style and the force of Western Christian missionary enthusiasm, which was sweeping the so-called uncivilized world. As if that was not enough, there was an imperialist and political onslaught by marauding colonial powers all over the continent of Africa and elsewhere. We repeat, as if that was not enough. Traditional societies all around the world were being invaded as a result of human avarice. It was in the interest of these powers to divide and rule. By and large, they succeeded until the veritable winds of change began to blow through the continent of Africa and perhaps the West Indies. To borrow Wells' words from William Shakespeare, this indeed was the winter of our discontent, made glorious summer by these sons and daughters of our soul, of our soil, who we celebrate through the year 2012. For more than 8 decades, the center of the African National Congress has always held. We trust that it shall continue holding for more generations to come. That is the hope that all Africa holds. President Sata of Zambia congratulated the African National Congress when he said, "It is remarkable that in 100 years, the organization adhered to its principles and the Freedom Charter." The year 2012 is both the end and a new beginning. The family of John Langalibalele Dube, umafuze elonjengezulu, and the J.L. Dube Foundation, wish the African National Congress all there is to wish for an institution for which we have developed an unshakable passion and affinity. The year 1994, when black South Africans gained freedom and liberation from what is easily the most violent and demeaning form of racial oppression that the world has ever known, is just as important. These landmarks are a measure of the success or failure of the African National Congress, going back 100 years and going forward into the uncharted future. We cannot doubt as a country and a people that we bear the responsibility not to disappoint Africa. How can we doubt it when on the seventh day of this month, so many heads of African states told us so, and in no uncertain terms. President Yoweri Museveni of Uganda put it in such a simple but fundamental manner when he said, "The best insurance policy that any patriot can take is to ensure that his country works and works well." Today we have a non-racial and non-sexist society, a Bill of Rights, and one of the most progressive constitutions in the world. We need to go out and prove to all and sundry that we are deserving of our freedom, and that our Constitution and Bill of Rights are worth the paper they are written on. A challenge seems more formidable than that of the men and women who brought us here. As a country and nation, we have a dire shortage of skills. We have a high level of unemployment and growing levels of poverty. The divide between the rich and the poor keeps growing. Some of these things are perfect ingredients for revolution. Ladies and gentlemen, in whatever way possible, let every man and woman of South Africa put their shoulder to the wheel so that together as one, we can achieve another miracle.
And that, a presentation overnight from South Africa by Amani Jale about the centennial of the African National Congress and its first president, John Dube. This is 5 o'clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight, and it is our great honor today to be joined by His Excellency, Consul General George Manyamengane. Welcome, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Knight, and good afternoon to your listeners.
Well, I'm even more honored by the significance of this day, which marks your first anniversary as Consul General.
Oh, thank you very much for that as well.
So for being with us on such a significant day, we're quite pleased. You have a background in economics and trade. You come from the Limpopo province.
That's correct.
Yes. Yeah, you've studied at Harvard. You're qualified by the World Trade Organization to represent international economic developments, as you did with Angola and Mozambique, and perhaps others. I know you have some expertise in regard to Chinese economics and relations with South Africa. And I'd just like to begin reflecting on the history of the ANC and this very special moment for South Africa. Can you give us some idea of how South Africans see the role of their nation, the global and historical significance of being one of very few black majority population areas that has successfully overcome policy of apartheid, enslavement, and colonization of many different forms? One can almost count on one hand, whether it be Haiti, yes. at the beginning of the 19th century, Absolutely. Or maybe Zimbabwe, or perhaps a few others. But how do you see the significance of South Africa?
Well, I think South Africa is very significant in a lot of ways, and I think as we have just aptly stated, the centennial celebrations of the African National Congress, which played a very critical role in delivering the freedom that we today, the people of South Africa, enjoy, was actually quite critical. Firstly, I would just like to highlight the fact that it was very important, as you know, the ANC today remains the oldest liberation movement. We turned 100 a few days ago, that is on the 8th of January. But secondly, because it still remains the ruling party within South African politics, as you know, that is the ruling party within the South African government. It has played a very critical role, not in terms of delivering liberation to the people of South Africa, but in also ensuring that our transformation and transition from a very horrible past, which was defined by apartheid and the subjugation of the black population within South Africa, you know, had to be overcome in such a way that we could move forward. Indeed, as we speak today, we are now, our nascent democracy is in its 17th year, and we have seen it grow in leaps and bounds. I think South Africans have now really embedded themselves, and not only in the democracy, but in the constitution, which we believe it's probably one of the best constitutions in the world. So we have seen quite a major movement forward. We believe that we can play a role in global terms. We can also play a very significant role in terms of ensuring that as we strive for sustainable development, we will bring along the entire African continent.
Let's look at some of the issues that are being faced in bringing majority benefits to the majority population. The rate of progress of reversing the inequities, the economic, labor, rights, transportation, education inequities that the African population faced for so many decades or more than a century. Are there remnant legacies of apartheid that remain to be overcome?
There are still a few. I think it's very important to note the fact that we are talking about decades of neglect, decades of decimation, where people were deprived of their rights, you know, to engage in an equal manner, you know, in being who they are. And our government has only been in 17 years, but we're of the view that a lot of good work has been done. Maybe just to give you an example, as we speak, you know, over 87% of South Africans have access to electricity. In fact, if you were to compare that situation with our scenario in 1994, I think we could have easily been sitting at about 40, somewhere there. You know, I mean, the figures can always be verified. But there has been a major move in terms of ensuring that we provide electricity for everybody throughout the country. And our government is not resting still as we speak. A lot of efforts are going into ensuring that 100% of the population should have access to electricity. The same could be said about clean and running water. The same could be said about other services that we believe are basic, that the government has actually gone all out to try and ensure that those are provided to the citizens of South Africa. Yes, there have been hiccups here and there. We know that we still face you know, certain challenges with housing, but the government has by now built more than 2 million houses, you know, for those who would not have had an opportunity to actually own or live in decent housing during the apartheid regime. But those are just some of the goals that we're beginning to realize. And through other forms of empowerment, we have also seen a steady rise and in terms of the economic well-being and the socioeconomic well-being, I would say, of citizens who would not have access to that in the past.
On the issue of economic well-being, it's my understanding that the African population has an extraordinarily high unemployment rate and that the levels of income still have some discrepancies among the different classes or groupings of people. in South Africa, what do you think about the rate at which that is being addressed, and what are the obstacles that cause this condition to persist? Is it a matter of economics? Is it a matter of infrastructure? Or how do you see that problem?
Well, I think the problem has been addressed in different, you know, in different ways. Firstly, let me say that you know, our government has actually pursued a path that we consider to be developmental in nature by ensuring that infrastructure is provided in areas which it was not in the past. You know, roads. You know, it could be, you know, any form of infrastructure that you can think of in the first place. We also do acknowledge that even though the levels of development, if you were to look at just pure income, may have been uneven, but one should not forget the fact that we have also seen the development of a very critical mass of black entrepreneurs, the black middle class, you know, in quite huge numbers. And I think the challenge that we face, perhaps in retrospect, is to try and ensure that we continue to narrow the gap that may exist between those that are in good space in terms of socioeconomic standing and those that are not. And that is precisely why our government has, in the past year or so, passed what we call the New Growth Path, which is a plan that seeks to ensure that through the development of our economy, through the provision of infrastructure, through the provision of other other assistance, we will then begin to create the necessary amount of jobs that our country requires in order to move out of the relatively large unemployment rate that we currently face. And we begin, and we believe that it is beginning to make an impact, and it will continue to make an impact as we go far. You may be very well aware, I think, sitting here in the U.S., that 2008 was quite, you know, atrocious, you know, to a lot of the economies throughout the world, you know, the global financial meltdown. But I think we were fortunate to a large extent that because of the prudent nature of our banks and the monetary policy that we had, the impact was not as bad as we thought it would be. And that, in a way, provided a cushion for the government, for our people, to make sure that, you know, we recover, you know, as soon as the time would allow. We would also like to see a scenario where we can grow our economy at an enough rate and create enough jobs, you know, to make sure that we can absorb the right amount of people into the work stream.
I'm aware that as far back as 2007, when you were the Director of Trade and Industrialization in South Africa, that you were involved or aware of the balance of investment difference between South Africa and China in terms of reciprocal investments and the sectors in which investments were made, and whether they were mineral-based or whether they had ancillary benefits for the population. And in regard to that, and South Africa's economic relationships with other nations or blocs, yeah, you correctly point out the meltdown of the belief system of global economies. And I'm wondering where the opportunities are and where the deficits are in terms of South Africa's role in a global economy.
Well, I think it is very important maybe just to highlight a few critical issues. Firstly, just to mention the fact that we are indeed the largest economy on the African continent. And perhaps those who would like to delineate, you know, we are the largest economy within sub-Saharan Africa. And we're acutely aware of the fact that our economy is also inextricably linked to that of Southern Africa and to that of the continent in certain ways. And as a country, we have also invested quite heavily within the African continent, because we believe in regional integration. We believe that by taking advantage of, you know, in fact, let me say, by using comparative advantages, you know, optimally, African countries can begin to realize their worth. They can also take their rightful place within the global economy in general. And as South Africa, we share trade and investment relations with different nations throughout the globe. One of those, maybe, that I would start with would be the U.S., that we've always enjoyed a very good trade and investment relationship with the United States. We've seen it growing, you know, in the post-apartheid era. In fact, this year we expect to surpass an amount of $16 billion in terms of two-way trade, and we remain the U.S.'s 28th largest trading partner. Now, if you were to consider the size of South Africa, that is quite huge by any standards, and we would like to see this type of relationship growing over the years. A large part of this relationship is also driven by what we call AGOA, which is the Africa Growth and Opportunities Act, which was signed between the United States and African countries, which basically offers African countries an opportunity, you know, to export into the U.S. market, you know, in some cases on a quota-free or on a duty-free basis, which comes to an end in 2015. There are all sorts of efforts to try and ensure that AGOA is actually extended beyond 2015 as we move along. So a lot of relations from a trade and investment, from a cultural and also from a political, because we believe that that is also important as we begin to tackle the challenges that emanate within the global scenario. We also share relations with other European countries. In fact, the EU is still a significant trade and investment partner to South Africa. So is China, which has also emerged quite largely over the past few years, both in terms of trade and investments. In fact, now China has become South Africa's number one trading partner. However, most importantly, as you are aware, we have also joined what we refer to as BRICS, which is Brazil, China, India, and Russia. You know, we've become part of, you know, these are emerging economies that are beginning to play a very meaningful role throughout the world. And we are beginning to make sure that their contributions, whether it be from a political or from an economic perspective, is also taken note of. And we believe that this has really been one of the greatest achievements by South Africa, and we hope to continue to build on that.
There has been talk of the internal economic continuity of the African continent, and I'm wondering, what is the state of enhancement of regional trade, and whatever happened to that dream of there being an African dinar, as there is a U.S. dollar, as there is a euro?
Well, plans are still underway to try and ensure that the AU moves into what is called, you know, the economic community, which has been which is planned, you know, to eventuate sometime in 2018. But in order to be able to do that, you know, you have to go through certain exercises. I think as we see now, we have seen deeper regional integration actually taking place within the five economic regions of the AU, you know, such as SADC, which is the Southern African Development Community, the ECOWAS, which is more the Western. So a lot of steps have gone into that. Now, that has even become more important because we believe that Africa really will begin to take its place and realize its economic might, particularly in the 21st century, because of the resources that are available within Africa, because a lot of the African countries have begun to really grow at rates that we believe are appropriate with, you know, given the amount of resources that they have. In fact, if you were to look at the latest World Bank report of doing business in Africa, it does confirm indeed that seven out of the top fastest growing economies in the world will be located in Africa. Secondly, we have also seen a scenario where the majority, in fact, of the population in Africa is made up of the youth who are getting skilled and who are getting educated as we go along, and who will play a critical role in ensuring that Africa realizes its own socioeconomic growth. So that is going to become very important as we go forward. A lot of innovation has come through the African continent. I think specifically maybe to speak about South Africa itself, despite the several challenges that we have, we've seen a lot of innovative exercises, both from a technology perspective, from a manufacturing perspective. If you were to look at the bouquet of our exports, even into the United States, they tell a story of a country that is doing quite well in terms of manufacturing, because we also export very high tech, very goods into the U.S., including citrus fruits, of course, which is an area that we're very strong on, and our very highly regarded wines into the U.S. market.
Well, I must investigate that. One of the things that we discussed here with Ayanda Shloshlo was the concept in South Africa that the fruits of the earth belong to the people of South Africa. And it's my understanding that a statute or an impulse that created a national South African mining company is being rejuvenated under the current government and intends to be one of the major players in mineral mining and such. What is your understanding of that, and to what degree would its operations be held in trust for the people and distributed to the people, and what is the difference between that and nationalization?
Well, there is a huge difference. I think, firstly, let me just start by saying that there will be a ministry, probably a cluster of economic ministries, that would oversee the operation of such a particular company, which will be governed by the normal regulations of doing business within the South African context. And that's how we view it. As to how it is constituted, I'm sure someone can do research or do more investigation into that, but we are aware of that. But that in itself is very different, and it's not linked to nationalization as well. I think it would be important to very specifically posit the fact that nationalization is not the South African government's policy as it is. But we are nonetheless, however, aware about the fact that the African National Congress, which is the ruling party, is doing research into that. But that is research. No decision has ever been made. It is not South Africa's government policy. In fact, our president and our Minister of Mineral Resources have on several occasions come out to highlight that particular fact. And I can just recall that sometime in March or April in the past year, our Minister of Mineral Resources actually did a roadshow even within the U.S. and the rest of North America to try and highlight that particular fact. So as we go forward, policies change, depending on the circumstances, but we normally communicate the current policy as seen fit by the current government, and that's where we are at this stage.
This is 5 o'clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight. We're speaking with George Manyamengene, Consul General. And this is a very special time for South Africa. The country took over the presidency, the rotating presidency of the United Nations Security Council in this month of January, and President Jacob Zuma, I believe, was here for some of the opening meetings of that just a few days ago. And what is the importance or significance of that position, and what kind of leadership do you hope to see South Africa bringing forward in that role?
Yes, indeed. We are currently the president of the Security Council within the United Nations. And our government hopes to use this particular period in a fruitful way. A few positions have actually been put forth. And among those is the fact that, as our president very publicly stated, he would like to see, stronger linkages and stronger ties in terms of how the UN works with the African Union, because we work within the auspices of the African Union. And we hope that that will be strengthened.
Well, I think it's a very important position, and one that requires extraordinary leadership in these dangerous times when military interventions threaten every nation on this planet today. And one such issue that I feel compelled to
raise and discuss is what happened to Libya. The Security Council intervened with two different resolutions and led to a situation with, well, at best, we can say pessimistic or mixed consequences. I would also point out or acknowledge that President Zuma did just a couple of days ago address this issue. And this is just a brief summary of President Zuma's statement in regard to the Security Council and African security.
While leading a United Nations Security Council meeting, South Africa's president complained the Security Council completely ignored an African Union plan on Libya. He also said the resolution that allowed NATO military action in Libya was largely abused.
South Africa's president, Jacob Zuma, is criticizing the United Nations Security Council for its resolution allowing NATO to bomb Libya.
It is the view of the AU that the 1973 resolution of the United Nations Security Council was largely abused in some specific respects.
While leading a Security Council meeting about ways to improve cooperation between the UN and African Union on Thursday, Zuma complained that the UN ignored the African Union plan for resolving the Libyan conflict.
The AU's plan was completely ignored in favor of bombing Libya by NATO forces. The consequences of actions that were carried out in Libya in the name of the United Nations Security Council have spilled over into other countries in the region.
United States Ambassador to the UN, Susan Rice, stressed the need for greater cooperation, but added that the final decision on international security issues are made by the Security Council.
Under the Charter, the Security Council has a unique, universal, and primary mandate to maintain international peace and security. The Security Council is not subordinate to other bodies, nor to the schedules or capacities of regional or sub-regional groups.
During the meeting, UN Chief Ban Ki-moon attempted to assuage tensions by saying there was more room for improvement.
There will be differences. That is nature. Organizations with different mandates, membership, and perspectives will occasionally have differences in approach. The question is how we manage those differences, how we work together.
Last March, South Africa abstained in the Council's Resolution 1973 that called for military action in Libya.
That recent report from the Chinese news agency NTDTV, and Your Excellency, I think there may have been an error in the last statement of that. Is, as I recall the record on the two resolutions in regard to Libya this spring, on Resolution 1973, which authorized military operations, there were only Brazil, China, Germany, India, and Russia who abstained, and the other nations, including South Africa, unless I'm mistaken, did vote for that. And the prior one calling for international criminal court intervention and so on, Resolution 1970 in February, was unanimously passed by the Security Council. And given the horrific circumstances of the combat in Libya and the dearth of discussion of breaking of the arms embargo by the training of seditious rebels in Libya, the massive participation of nations like Qatar in arming and training and transporting the rebels in and out of the country, SAS operations, U.S. clandestine operations, and so on. One must ask the question whether a Pandora's box was unleashed by these operations of the UN and of the Security Council, leading to what has now become, in some ways, an apartheid state in Libya, in which Libyans of African hue are being rounded up, discriminated, thousands, perhaps tens of thousands of them still imprisoned or corralled without due judicial process. Were errors made in countenancing this massive unbalanced discussion and intervention in Libya?
Well, it's very difficult for me really to comment on that particular question, and I'm just going to explain why. Firstly, just purely for the mere fact that I think South Africa's position was very well articulated. In fact, I'm very happy that you were able to play the clip that just went on before you passed this question, because again, our president really, in a very succinct manner, outlined our position on some of those issues. But more than anything else, because we don't directly deal with the UN or issues related to the Security Council, I would be more than happy, to arrange, a very clear engagement and maybe an interview that can give you a good interface with our permanent representative to the United Nations, who can actually give you, maybe provide you with very clear answers to some of those questions. And and I'm very sorry that I'm unable to provide you with any more with any answers or any information on those.
Well, I appreciate your discretion and the opportunity for such education. We would, of course, welcome that. And speaking of education, how fares that as one of the stepping stones of the improvement of the masses of the population in South Africa?
Well, you can never understate the importance of education. In fact, for ourselves as the consulate, we also place quite a significant amount of time in terms of, doing some linkages when it comes to education, either both in the form of knowledge exchanges, people-to-people exchanges, institutional linkages, because we do believe that that is very critical as we move along. And we are also aware about the fact that you cannot in any way underplay the econometric linkage that exists between economic development and education, because people need to be skilled, people need to be trained, people need to be able to interact with their environments and within the economy to make sure that whatever they do from a socioeconomic perspective, will result in optimum benefits. So that is very critical. Our government has also, over the years, actually plowed a lot of resources into education to try and ensure that our kids and are educated, or those that want to get educated through adult education programs can also go back and study, because education indeed does not discriminate. Anybody at any age can go back and acquire skills or educate themselves in whatever way they want to.
What is the relationship between those who seek higher education and the capacity of the universities?
Well, it's a very interesting question, because as South Africa, we face very interesting challenges, because we have the best of the very best, even in terms of academic institution, and we do have academic institutions that need, to be assisted, that are growing, and that we believe will become quite well as we go along. In fact, this very morning, during some of our discussions, as people who are based in the United States, we also realized that, in fact, even a lot of U.S. students are beginning to study in South Africa, even undergraduate students, postgraduate students. During the month of January and December, etc., we process a lot of study visas, because a lot of students go and study in South Africa. So we believe that those are very healthy exchanges. But they also validate the fact that we also have some of, some world-class institutions within South Africa.
This is 5 O'Clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight, and we're speaking with the Consul General in New York of South Africa, George Manye Mangene. And Your Excellency, as a journalist, there is one unavoidable question I must ask you about in South Africa, and I think it touches on education. Yeah. Transparency sometimes requires revelation. I think the world has learned much from WikiLeaks about the way things operate behind the scenes of the press releases. And many people have asked, and I appreciate the chance to ask you, about the National Press Security Law that is under consideration in South Africa. I'm told that even some members of the ANC in the legislative branch have been pressured to support it. It would criminalize the leaking of many things that some reporters would say is whistleblowing in order to diminish corruption or to serve the public interest. Why is there not, or will there ever be, consideration of public interest exculpation in regard to this national security press law?
Well, my understanding, and which is very reflective of what our government has done, you know, a lot of it has actually gone into this particular law. A lot of hearings have gone, a lot of consultation has gone ahead, and I don't think there has been any pressure that has been applied on anybody. I can nonetheless tell you that I can think of very few, if any, countries that can really match South Africa's press freedom. You know, indeed, you know, the press is quite free to report or address whatever issues they may come across the entire spectrum, you know, of news. I think, you know, it was very, very well articulated in terms of why there was a need, you know, for this particular bill at that particular time to go on. It addresses a very particular security and a very particular government related area of work. And based on the articulation that had been given and based on the fact that it is not in any way going to impinge, you know, on the freedoms of our press. People always hold a different opinion when it comes to some of these issues. But I continue to believe that we're a very open, indeed very free society where the press is normally able to report and cover news as they see fit.
One of the things that I've heard from some South Africans is a sense of consternation about a certain kind of, if not ethnic or attitudinal or historical bias among some of the publications that are not necessarily locally owned. And do you think that that is at issue here to any extent? And while on that point, what is being done to encourage indigenous South African media, or to expand it, in the sense that President Zuma was referring to just the other day when he said that the stories of South Africans need to be told with understanding and sympathy and not manipulated?
Well, I think when it comes to the former question, I very much doubt. We have not come across a scenario where anybody has been discriminated against because they happen to be a non-South African and holding any particular media house. And I know that it has not been an issue within the South African sense. In fact, if anything, our government has played a very critical role in terms of ensuring that there's media diversity in all its forms. In fact, recently our president has appointed new board members, you know, to our own media transformation and diversity agency to try and ensure that the type of diversity that we require, whether it be in the form of ownership or whether it be in the form of making sure that indeed, as we are a society that revels in our unity in diversity, that diversity is carried forward as a result.
Well, certainly on the in the interest of completeness, I think we also have to acknowledge the inspirational role that South Africa has played in advancing the concept of a truth commission, yeah, coming out of historical trauma. And so I do not want this encounter to involve truth omission either. So,
well, I hope we don't. We are not in the business of omitting, you know, or detracting, you know, from the truth. And but we are here to tell it as it is, you know, to tell it like it is, if one may use one of the most fabled phrases.
Well, and on that culmination, I leave the floor open to you to envision how South Africa might be moving in the next, I won't even ask you for the next century, I'll settle for your projections and intentions for South Africa's development and realization in the next half century.
Thank you. Well, I think from a South African perspective, We envisage a nation that is at peace, that continues to be very stable. We envision our region, you know, to be at peace and to enjoy stability and to enjoy very great relations with the rest of the world. And I think to a large extent, you know, we have begun to realize that over the past few years. We do have certain challenges that we believe we will be able to address as we go forward, like any other country. We would like to see a scenario where we completely eradicate poverty, which is also something that is being addressed through the Millennium Development Goals, which has set goals to make sure that people must make certain progress by 2015. So we would like to see the advancement. We would like to make sure that we provide basic services to our own populace and that everybody who deserves and who is within the African continent should also begin to enjoy improved services in a nutshell. And this is something that we hope will continue to happen. South Africa has a lot of potential. I would like to use this opportunity just to highlight the fact that we are open for business. We continue to do business with the U.S., with a lot of people that are based here. We have a very good investment climate where people can come and do business and realize returns like they would in any particular country. We are also a country that provides opportunities in a lot of other different ways with a very dynamic human capital that we believe can be accessed should people be interested in engaging with ourselves. In that respect, we do engage with different sectors within the U.S. To try and make sure that we disseminate this type of information. We encourage people to go and have a look and go and see if they can exploit some of the opportunities that exist in infrastructure, in agribusiness, in tourism, and in a lot of other areas. It would be really an injustice, you know, if I were to omit the fact that we held a very successful 2010 World Cup. And we believe that that in itself was a great showcase of what South Africa can do. It went very well. It was a great success. It also helped us to showcase the beauty that South Africa is. And that is why we encourage people to go to South Africa whenever they get an opportunity.
Well, we are certainly appreciative of this opportunity today to speak with you, Your Excellency. We've been speaking with George Banyamangene, the Consul General of South Africa here in New York City. And that concludes today's edition of 5 O'Clock Shadow. And I'd like to give thanks to Michael G. Haskins for engineering, Duduzo, and all the rest of the staff, Kathy Davis, Tony Bates, Pietro Reimers, Andrea Katz, and you, the listeners who make this radio station able to speak truth to power. If you want to be in touch, send us an email to theshadow@wbai.org, for which I'm Robert Knight in New York.